Today's guest on Medio Scientific's The Business of LoRaWAN is Lilianne Paradise, COO of MiroMiko. Lilianne leads one of the most technically advanced IoT hardware teams in Europe, where she's guiding the development of rugged modular gateways and pioneering ultra-low power sensor systems, some even fully battery-free. From proof of concept to mass production, she oversees the entire arc of building industrial-grade LoRaWAN solutions with Swiss-level precision. Before stepping into executive leadership, she earned her chops as a hands-on hardware engineer, helping build MiroMiko's earliest LoRa devices before the LoRaWAN spec even existed. That depth shows. Whether it's pushing energy harvesting into real-world deployments or designing every product for testability and manufacturing from day one, she's making hard technical decisions with clear business outcomes. In this conversation, we cover the promise and trade-offs of battery-free IoT, the practical realities of hybrid power systems, and why cybersecurity and interoperability will drive the next phase of LPWAN growth. We also get into MIOTI, MiroMiko's manufacturing philosophy, and how they use early customer feedback to validate value, not just functionality. This episode is sponsored by the Helium Foundation's IoT Working Group. Helium offers global LoRaWAN coverage and is used by everyone from hobbyists to businesses deploying countrywide networks. If you'd like to see if Helium coverage exists near you, check out the links in the show notes. To get started using Helium today, you can sign up for a console account with Medio Scientific at console.medioscientific.com. Now, let's dig into the conversation with Lilianne Paradise. Lilianne, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Welcome. Thanks for the invite. Super thrilled to be here.
Super psyched to have you on. I think Robert Boggs had recommended you come on, and you and I have been talking for a hot minute. Looking into your background, I guess I've got to start with this obsession with RF, like you're super psyched on radio stuff. What drives that?
Yeah, so we at MiroMiko, we're actually coming from a background of IC design, but from where we branched out to embedded, because our CTO, Alex Raimondi, he always had an obsession with RF. And actually, we were doing LoRa before there was even a LoRaWAN standard. So we were always really one of the first to fiddle around with antennas and with RF and with new protocols. For example, one of our first LoRa projects that was even before there was a LoRaWAN standard was to build remote controls for racing drones.
Huh. Okay, that was all on LoRa. I can't imagine that has a ton of bandwidth. So those things must just go left, go right, go up, go down, go faster, go slower. Like
actually, you can get the latency down if you do LoRa, just the modulation and not the LoRaWAN protocol on top.
Okay.
Of course, if you have LoRaWAN, you have the delays from the TX, RX window timing, but you can get a lot of more bandwidth through if you just use the LoRa as a physical modulation. And the beauty is, compared to other technologies, you get a hell of a lot of range. You get all these kilometers, like
it's
tens
crazy,
of kilometers,
right?
in rural environments. So that's the beauty about the LoRa modulation. And it's not tied. I mean, the LoRaWAN standard is great, but the beauty is that it's not tied to it. You can use it separately and build really, really cool solutions based on own protocols.
Yeah.
And that's where we're really, really strong.
Yeah. And I think we're seeing that in the kind of wider LoRa world with the rise of Meshtastic and then the Loco tracker, stuff like that, where people are just saying, hey, we're just going to use LoRa. We're not even going to get into the LoRaWAN. And of course, there's, you know, different solutions for different problems. Is there a favorite LoRaWAN device that you have? Is there something that you've worked on over the years? You're like, oh, this is awesome.
Well, on one hand, of course, it's our gateways. We put a lot of love and effort and passion in our gateways. Worked on getting them as rugged as possible and as versatile as possible. What does that mean in practice? Our philosophy is always to keep products modular, meaning that now we have a LoRaWAN gateway, but we built it in such a modular way that it was really easy and simple for us to build a MIOTI gateway, which is a new, also awesome LPWAN technology that came up a few years ago and is starting to get really popular. And that's not the limit. We can build a BLE gateway out of it. We have Wi-Fi support on it. So that's for sure one of the products that I personally really love and have a passion for. It might sound a bit weird because the gateway is always in the background. It's invisible. But think about it. If the gateway fails, then you can have all the fancy sensors you want. It just doesn't work. So it's the silent but very, very necessary part of every network. And it's the one part that cannot fail and the one part that must be secure.
Yeah, we'll hit some security stuff later because I saw reading up on you that you're into the security piece, but let's pause for a second on this MIOTI piece. I'm hearing a bunch about it. Obviously, it's not LoRaWAN, but it's important to not kind of ignore the competition out there or the other solutions out there. Give me your perspective on LoRaWAN, MIOTI, kind of what they are doing that you're excited about?
So the main difference from a technical perspective is that LoRaWAN, of course, they use the LoRa modulation, which gives great range, but they, you basically send out the package or your whole payload message as one package. And when you have an interference, you lose your whole message. And that's where MIOTI comes in. They have the so-called TSMA, Telegram Splitting Multiple Access technology, where they split the telegrams into small sub-packets. And then they spread them over time, but also over frequency. So you're very, very narrow. You're somewhere around 3 kilohertz in bandwidth. And that's just in a probabilistic calculation, you're much, much less likely to have collisions. Plus on MIOTI, you also have higher forward error correction, which then in turn means that you can still, even though it's not that probable, you can still lose a few of your packets. Actually, to be technically correct, you can lose up to 50% of your sub packets and still restore your original telegram. And our experiments have shown, so we have on a local cell tower in Zurich, close to our office, we installed a gateway roughly a year ago. That's actually almost an anniversary here. And I have some sensors registered there and I didn't lose a single packet yet. So that's quite impressive.
Yeah. It's pretty. It reminds me a little bit of Telemaco was on over at EchoStar was telling about this. What is it? FHSS, the long range frequency something spread spectrum. The yes. Same kind of thing. Is that right?
Yes, it goes in a very similar direction. It's not one to one the same. And actually, there are some interesting studies that were conducted by TU Ilmenau that compare the two. They have quite a similar concept behind. That's true.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not the most technological guy, so I that's probably as much as I can understand, but it's good to hear that my understanding of it is good enough that they're similar. Okay. So that's LoRaWAN, MIOTI stuff. Let's talk a little bit about something I know you're psyched on, which is this energy harvesting and the push either to battery-free or hybrid battery. How are you thinking about that for LoRaWAN devices and what are the implications?
Yeah. So maybe let's start with a little bit of a background. During COVID, we started to deploy large numbers of ambient sensors. So they measure temperature, humidity, but mostly also CO2 in order to ensure the well-being in offices, hospitals, schools. And back then, people were thrilled because we can promise battery lifetimes up to 10 years. That was 5 years ago, roughly. And now, of course, the 10 years are, if you're lucky with SF7, and now some of the first sensors that might be in a not so good location, RF-wise, far away from a gateway, they start to deplete and people start to realize that it will be a huge operational effort to replace all these batteries. And that's one aspect. And then the second aspect for sure is the trash and the toxic waste that you are producing. And that's why not just we as a company, but I think also the European Union, of course, Switzerland is not part of it, but we try to move with them, will have directives on how many batteries you can use or if you're even allowed to use primary batteries. So I think for every IoT company, it will be critical to bring out energy harvesting solutions. And that's what we did. We already successfully brought our Miro Insight Lux to the market, which is completely battery free and offers all the benefits our battery-powered sensors have. So all the sensors can be supported. And of course, we have a secondary backup storage there. We have a supercapacitor, which is more environmental friendly than a primary battery would be. And it helps to make it through not just one night, but up to 60 nights or 60 wow. full days, to be more precise, without recharging. So that's quite impressive where technology has led us. And that's, of course, thanks to protocols like LoRaWAN and MIOTI and also the chip manufacturers, which really brought down the energy consumption of the MCUs and the sensors really, really low.
Yeah. Interesting. And then talk me through this idea of going battery-free versus a hybrid and what is kind of marketing hype and what is practical and then where it might go in the long term.
So as we see on LinkedIn and basically on every platform, every magazine, so everyone wants to go completely battery free, which is understandable from a sustainability perspective. But in reality, we see, okay, if the sensor measurement is completely uncritical and it's a nice to have, then battery free is the way to go. But in many cases, the monitoring is more than just a nice to have. In some cases, companies must comply with CO2 levels, or they want to monitor, for example, the state of doors that shouldn't be open for too long. they need to send out alerts. Let's say in pharma industry, you have a cooled room. If the door is open for too long, all these medications go bad. And in that case, you cannot risk having an outage because you didn't get light for too long. And in that case, hybrid systems will be really, really important. What does that mean? A hybrid system means we still have a primary battery in there, but we extend the battery lifetime by the means of energy harvesting.
Got it. Okay. So it's this thing where it's like, hey, energy harvesting and battery free sounds good, but for right now, let's make sure we have a decent backup. So if you have a critical sensor, you're still going to get your information.
Yes, yes. I think that especially in industrial settings, it will be critical to have like these hybrid systems because we're talking about dirty environment. We cannot guarantee that the solar cell or the whatever the harvesting technology you're using is always operational.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can get behind that. And as fun as the energy harvesting is, it does make sense. Like, hey, let's make sure this thing continues to work, even if it has a cool looking screen on the front.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So Miro Miko, you've brought a bunch of new stuff. You kind of watched a bunch of devices go from concept to, you know, in your hand. Can you walk me through the arc of what that looks like as far as like, how does that happen? And what do you have to think of as you're going through that arc?
Yeah, 100%. So maybe to start with, we are 100% a customer-driven company. So usually an idea starts together with a vision very often from a customer or a partner. And from that vision, we try to build a POC, proof of concept, very fast. And then once you have a proof of concept, what we will want to do is to kind of have a proof of value, which sounds fancy, but in the end means we don't need to show anymore that we can build it. We want to show that we can actually add value to our customers. That means in practice, we will send out these POC devices to our alpha or beta customers and see what value can they actually gain and can we keep the promise that we're giving to our customers. So that will be the very first step, which we basically call technology and value evaluation. And from there, we usually go through 2 to 3 phases in the product development. It starts with the so-called MVP. It's not most valuable person. It stands for minimal viable product, which is a product that already looks like a product, has, let's say, 80 to 90% of the functionality it should, but it's not fully certified. And with that product, that minimal viable product, we will hit the market in a beta state. And we will, depending on the device, deploy a few hundreds to thousands of these devices. And this way we can gather the data, get the feedback from our customers and put it into the final product. And then the second stage will be the field testing improvements, where we do all the pre-certifications, we do all the quality control, so we ensure that all the environmental conditions can be dealt with and so on. And then the output of that phase will be a ready-to-be-industrialized device, and industrialization is then usually the setup for mass production. Because at Miro Miko, we don't do, oh, we test one device and then we ship out 1,000. At Miro Miko, we really value our quality. So every single device will be end-to-end tested. And of course, that takes some time to set up the whole production facilities.
Yeah, it's a very Swiss way of doing things. Like, we want this thing to be perfect, or it's going to be like a clock.
Yes, it has to be. That's the promise we give to our customers. I mean, there are competitors on the market that might offer it for a lower price, but we really value our quality, and actually a lot of our devices are end-to-end assembled in Switzerland itself.
Ah, that's pretty cool, yeah. That's unusual.
It's pretty unusual, I know. And a part of it is also social responsibility, not just for the environment. Of course, we like to have a value chain that's concentrated in the region, but also we work very closely with a partner that hires people with certain backgrounds of mental disability and physical disabilities. And that way, it's a nice social engagement as well.
God, the Swiss and the Euros are so nice. America's, I was thinking when you're talking about batteries and like, oh, we have to have batteries, like America's going to go find another planet. And the Euros are like, hey, we should actually just stay on this one and take care of this one.
This one is nice. We like it. Why should we trash it?
there's no good reason. Let's see. So this sounds like a pretty expensive way of doing things. What are the biggest cost drivers with, I guess, IoT devices and then IoT deployment?
So I would say on the device level, to ensure the quality, that's a big cost driver. especially. So the components you can buy and the components you buy in very similar conditions everywhere in the world, if you basic set of like negotiation skills, I would say. So what really makes the difference is where do you assemble your devices? And of course, how efficiently do you assemble the devices? So as I said, we assemble our devices in Switzerland. So in that perspective, we're more expensive than if we would do it maybe in some other geographical region of the world. So the way we optimize is that we try to make the devices as easy to assemble as possible. So we cut the time rather than the employee or staff cost.
Well, it's interesting. So you're building with more than just the end result in mind. It's also the processes included in how you're designing it.
I think an important keyword there is design for testability and for manufacturability, which means that we learned every screw will cost you a few seconds in production. So whenever you can have a clip-in where you can save the screwdriver, that already saves you a few seconds. The same if you can go for a fully automated test rig, that will save you more time than if someone has to be there and plug something in and observe a screen sequentially. And that's where we start in the very early design phase, that we have these thoughts how we will industrialize the product, not just in the very end, but at the beginning of the design cycle.
It sounds like very Japanese car manufacturing philosophy. It's like, hey, we're going to think about this whole thing and constantly improve it, the Kaizen stuff and the Deming stuff. Okay, super cool. Let's see. Let's finish up on this idea of what you see coming down the pipe next in LoRaWAN that you're super excited about. And maybe it's LPWAN. I know you're psyched on this MIOTI stuff, but what do you see in the next year to 5 years that you're pumped on?
Yeah, so on one hand, as you already said, I think the multi-technology approach will become really big, not because, so we as Miromiko, we are a technology provider. We're not saying LoRaWAN versus MIOTI, one is better than the other, but I think the diversity will become really, really important. Also, there is no technology that fits every single use case. So having a variety of technologies to choose from and having them interoperable will be the next big thing. So also standardization between technologies, but also between device vendors will be a really big thing that will drive deployments. And we're asking about deployment costs. And I think that's one big issue, that you buy from different vendors and the devices are not interoperable and you will spend a lot of time to build your device models in your backend. That's a huge thing. And then, of course, the other huge thing that will come up that we are not so happy about as a device manufacturer, but that will be super, super important, is the European Cyber Resilience Act, which will ensure that devices, especially gateways, are more secure. I mean, the whole point of the initiative is to secure public infrastructure. And I think that will change how IoT devices are built as well.
Do you think that the European manufacturers will fall behind in the global marketplace because of that? Or do you think you'll come out ahead? Or what are the implications for the euros on that side?
I think it will perhaps push us back a bit for, let's say, 1 to 2 years, because let's be honest, cybersecurity is, if I may say so, a little bit of a pain in the sense of you need to do a lot of pen tests and so on to ensure that you're actually secure. But cybersecurity is a global topic, so maybe it will put us behind for a year, but then once the rest of the world will come up with similar initiatives, we will be ahead and we will have everything ready and then it will shift over.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. Come to California. We move faster out here. We're a little less safe, or we're pretty fast. Let's see. Do you think that AI will just solve this interoperability problem? That's what it seems like to me as like a non-technologist, is we're just going to apply the, you know, robot brains to this thing and that'll fix it? Or is that wishful thinking?
I think that the idea behind it or the direction is smart, or it can solve a huge part of it. I mean, we already see it with ChatGPT. I can put in like a bunch of payload decoder and say, build me a unified device model. So it will aid for sure. But at least from my perspective, you still need to be a good prompt engineer to tell the artificial intelligence what you want from it.
Okay.
So I think it's part of the solution, but there still need to be some brain power, some actual human-based brain power behind to see what we want to get out of it, because otherwise everyone builds their own standard. And if everyone has a standard, it's not a standard, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it still comes down to coding is easy, thinking is hard. That's how the world works.
So. Exactly.
Ripping. Well, Lillian, thanks for making the time to come on. I know you're super busy running Miromiko over there and crushing, so appreciate you making the time to come on.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of The Business of LoRaWAN. I built this for you. So whether you're a business owner, a LoRaWAN professional, or a hobbyist, the intent is to give you great LoRaWAN information. Of course, the best information doesn't come from me. It comes from the conversations we have with the people building and deploying this tech in the real world. And that's where you come in. LoRaWAN is a global patchwork of talent and ideas. And ironically, for a globally connected network, most of the brilliant folks working on it aren't connected yet. Help me change that. Introduce me to someone awesome in your network, someone doing meaningful work in LoRaWAN, or just shoot me a name. I'll take it from there and get them on the show so we can share their work with the world. You can always find me at metsci.show, that's metsci.show, metsci.show. If you want to support the show in other ways, you can subscribe, leave a review, share it with your corner of the world. All of those are super helpful. If you'd like to support financially, you can go to support.metsci.show for both one-time and recurring options. We're also open to sponsors. If your company serves the LoRaWAN community and you want to reach this dedicated audience, let's talk. If you want to try LoRaWAN for yourself, create a Medio Scientific account at console.medioscientific.com and get your first 400 DC for free, which is enough to run a device sending hourly for about a year. This show is supported by a grant from the Helium Foundation and produced by Gristle King, Inc. I'm Nick Hawks. I'll see you on the next show.